Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thanks.
So your book, Michael Lind, deals with these two threads in both American political and economic history, the Jeffersonian and the Hamiltonian, and Jefferson, of course, being against bigness and wanting to have small independent businessmen and farmers and other producers, Hamilton believing in large, powerful institutions and powerful organizations. And one of the great ironies, of course, is that the Republicans who today claim Jefferson and the Democrats today claim Hamilton, it's not entirely clear, because on the Jeffersonian line, you've got the Democrat Andrew Jackson, the leaders of the Confederacy, William Jennings Bryan, who ran against McKinley, Louis Brandeis, Barry Goldwater, and Ronald Reagan. And on the Hamiltonian line, which is now the Democratic Party, you've got George Washington, Henry Clay, Abraham Lincoln, William McKinley, and both Roosevelts, and Dwight Eisenhower. So how do you navigate through all of those contradictions?
Well, it's a matter of some tension sometimes. The Democrats have an annual Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner to celebrate the founding of their party. And I asked the late Democratic Senator from New York, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, what did they celebrate on Jefferson Jackson Day, states' rights, and the expulsion of the Cherokee to Oklahoma. He laughed. But it actually gets in, it's kind of serious in a way. When he began his administration, Bill Clinton, or may have been during the campaign in 1992, Bill Clinton made a pilgrimage to Monticello, the home of Jefferson, the nominal founder of the Democratic Party. 1998, he had me as a guest to the White House after I wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that the Democrats should be the Hamiltonian Party. And at that point, he agreed with me. Of course, politicians can agree with whoever they're talking to. So what's essentially happened is, I argue, that there's been continuity in these two traditions in the U.S. The parties have switched constituencies. Or names, if you want to put it that way, since the Civil Rights Revolution, when the white working class and the white South left for the Republicans, the moderate Rockefeller Republicans in the North have migrated en masse into the Democratic Party now. But if you don't look at...
Or been driven out of the Republican.
Or been driven out. They were fleeing. No. But if you don't look at the party labels, you look at the regions and the traditions, there is this what I call the Hamiltonian tradition of developmental capitalism. It sees the government, business, and in its more progressive versions, labor, as partners in a common project of economic nation building. And that has always been based in the Northeast and in the Midwest. And this rival Jeffersonian tradition, I think the Jacksonian tradition is just kind of a more raw-edged, more brutal version of Jeffersonianism. And that's always been based in the South, the tradition of states' rights, hostility to bigness. What I point out is neither tradition is necessarily pro-market. It's not libertarianism of the Ayn Rand or the Austrian school. Both the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians have always been in favor of government intervention in the economy for particular goals. The goal of the Hamiltonians is to modernize the economy as quickly as possible using advanced technology. The goal of the Jeffersonians has been a political and social goal. It's to preserve a majority of small producers, be they small farmers, small shopkeepers, small bankers. And in pursuit of that goal, the Jeffersonians have always favored fairly drastic interventions in the economy against bigger organizations, ranging from antitrust to anti-branch banking laws, which were very important for many generations in the U.S., punishing large banks, and so on.
And of course, the book points out that America's economic history has been a series of revolutions and counter-revolutions, with each revolution tied to a war, Revolutionary War, Civil War, and World War II.
Well, I argue that there have been three republics. even though we pretend we're still under the original Constitution of 1788. In fact, we do rebuild the country now and then, and it tends to be in these periods of crisis. And so the Second Republic was founded by Lincoln and his successors after the First Republic broke down during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Franklin Roosevelt and his successors, including Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon, who shared many of his premises, was built between the 1930s and the 1950s and 60s. I think we're living in the dying phases of the Third Republic that began with Roosevelt, and most of the second half of its history, beginning not just with Ronald Reagan, but also with Jimmy Carter, who was much more conservative than people remember, has been kind of a neo-Jeffersonian backlash against this earlier Hamiltonian nation-building period of Roosevelt through Nixon.
And that's the period that you call, the period we're in now, the Great Dismantling.
Yes, that's right. And it's quite clear in hindsight that the technology, economics, the recovery of Japan and West Germany, the stagnation of the world economy in the 70s, all of those things required a renovation of these New Deal era institutions that had been adopted for the quite different circumstances of the 1930s and 40s. What we got instead was this, to my mind, utopian belief that we don't need to modify regulations, we just need to get rid of them all. And the market will take care of all of this. And it's often forgotten, democratic economists like Charles Schulz, Alfred Kahn, who presided over the dismantling of airline regulation, these were Democrats. It wasn't simply Republicans who had this newfound faith in laissez-faire, which most of an older generation of conservatives had lost.
Right, but the most enduring and the most influential of the economists, of course, was Alan Greenspan, the former executor of Ayn Rand's
That's
will,
right.
And a total devotee of Ayn Rand, who then became, under Reagan, the head of the Fed. And, of course, basically, in many ways, people argue he ran the Clinton economy.
But it's more a kind of a worldview. And the Chicago School of Milton Friedman is really a fundamental, influencing a lot of so-called neoliberal Democrats. Like Larry Summers and Robert Rubin, as well as conservative Republicans. So there was kind of a bipartisan consensus, which included modern Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon during the New Deal era. It was succeeded in the 70s and 80s by a new consensus, which lasts to this day. A high-ranking former Obama administration official told me one time, we don't believe in regulation. We believe in transparency and market incentives. Right, so this is still very much that 1980s, 1990s mindset. I had thought it would have been shaken up more by the greatest global depression since the 30s, but so far, you still have the established consensus on both sides of the Atlantic. Not only is in place, but it's leading to potentially suicidal policies like austerity in Europe, and the cutting back of state and local spending in the U.S., which has neutralized what good effects the federal stimulus might have done.
Now, when the Great Dismantling began, it's concurrent, that's the mid-70s, under Carter, but it was also the time of the famous Powell memo that was a response to the anti-Vietnam War and the hippies and peace, love, and dropping out and all that stuff. And it's sort of interesting in a way that some of the most powerful people in this country are those that rejected and were appalled by the free love of the 60s, the John Robertses, the Sam Alitos on the court, and the presidential candidate on the Republican side, Mitt Romney, who was deeply appalled by what happened. So the reaction has a face, but it seems to me that the idea of the Powell memo was the big business in this country has to wake up and get involved in politics, because we need, otherwise we're going to have, a whole generation of anti-capitalists.
That was one of a number of initiatives taken by the business elite to essentially end its 20-year truce or so with organized labor, going back to the Treaty of Detroit, so-called, in the early 1950s, where the big three auto companies negotiated with the labor unions. And then this kind of set an example for the rest of corporate America to treat unions as a part of the landscape that's legitimate in the way in much of Western Europe they're still considered, rather than simply enemies to be wiped out, which had been the view until then. I think when you look at these individuals, you have to ask, well, why did this particular thing happen at that particular time? Because there had been reactionaries, you know, writing memos about going after the unions in 1945 and 55 and 65, and nothing happened.
Right. Colonel McCormick.
Yeah, and so I think the context that changed was the slowdown of economic growth throughout the entire industrialized world. It's never been adequately explained by economists, although I think the best explanation among several is that the second industrial revolution based on automobiles as the central industry had not only until you got the computer revolution in the 90s, when you start putting more and more IT into cars. By the 1960s and 70s, the earlier Henry Ford paradigm of automobile technology, you'd pretty much rung all of the changes that you could do on that. And at the same time, you have Japan and West Germany, and in the case of Japan, very aggressive state promotion of exports, flooding the markets. So I think that that kind of structural surplus and the gluts that were driving down growth, it was even more important than some of the other factors like the oil crises around the same time in creating this climate of stagnation in which ideas that would have seemed too kooky and right-wing radical fringe 10 or 20 years before suddenly got a polite hearing.
But since this period that we're talking about, what you describe, Michael Lind, in your book, Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States, The Great Dismantling, we have seen the gradual takeover of our politics and our economy by an American elite, an oligarchy, if you will. And there's just been endless evidence about the disparity in wealth growing and growing and growing. There's Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision in many ways accelerated into the current political environment where a handful of billionaires, the 0.1% of the 1%, appear to be buying the next election. And this has led to this backlash movement, the 99% versus the 1%. The question is, has this, I mean, and in fact, you can argue that the elite is running a member of the 1% as their candidate. So what explains this the corporatization and the, I don't know what the word for an oligarchization of America, what explains the inexorable growth of it and the fact that in spite of the economic elite taking the global economy to the brink of collapse in 2008, they're back stronger than ever?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the perception of threat that is felt by the privileged elites. The last time in history where there was really no significant external great power threat in the decades following the Civil War, the Confederacy had been put down, the Mormons had been crushed, and the railroad strikers were pretty much suppressed with federal aid in the 1870s and 1880s, that's when you had the Gilded Age, right? I think there was a genuine establishment in the United States from World War II all the way up until the 70s. It wasn't because these were more virtuous people or they were less greedy or anything. It's just they were more frightened. They remembered Huey Long, the demagogue. They remembered the pitched battles between goons and company goons and labor organizers in the 30s. And they were really, really scared by what they had seen happen in Weimar Germany and in Russia and so on. And so there was this sense that there was a minimum amount of solidarity that was necessary. And there were also restraints on partisanship among the elite, if just for purely Machiavellian reasons, right? You couldn't just slaughter each other.
Well, I remember William F. Buckley and his best friend George McGovern had these very civilized debates on firing line on PBS.
Well, in my earlier neoconservative youth, I spent a week in Gstaad, Switzerland, vacationing with Bill Buckley and his then best friend, John Kenneth Galbraith. This really was a different world, right? Mm-hmm. Than the world of Rush Limbaugh and, you know, whoever the equivalent on the left
would be.
Take
no prisoners. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sorry to say, I think that we're still in that situation. And globalization has strengthened the hand, obviously, of investors and managers, because in the old days you could shut down the factory in Maine and move it to South Carolina and then move it to China or anywhere in the world.
Right. They've used globalization as an excuse for cutting loose their fellow citizens.
Yeah, and in the case of the Great Recession, which I expected to have more of an effect on shaking things up than it has done, and in thinking about why that has not been the case, I've concluded it was the success of the New Deal, particularly of unemployment insurance, which eliminated soup lines and the visible evidence of suffering. And so the elite, in which, you know, circles I move and you do as well, and in many cases, I'm sure, really has no idea how bad things are. Because you don't see people in lines on the street, right? You don't see the torchlight parades. So it's sort of a pessimistic vision. In the absence of a perceived internal threat and or an external threat, the incumbent elites of any societies, not just the United States, they don't have much of a motive in order to undertake reform. To the extent that I'm optimistic, it's because I'm pessimistic. I think we're at the beginning of what someone like E.H. Carr in retrospect will call the 20 years crisis or the 30 years crisis or something. That is, you know, when I see references to the recovery, this reminds me of 1931 when everyone thought the Depression was almost over, and then Credit Anstalt fails in Austria and brings down Germany. And so we're talking about the German and Central European economy today.
Right.
You know,
which George Soros says, I think a day ago he said they've got 3 days left before.
Well, you know, I don't want to sound like one of those crazy people asking you to send money for a newsletter about, you know, the coming crash, and you have
right.
to become a survivalist. But I, Reinhardt and Rogoff, these two economic historians, did a book. This time it's different, about financial crashes, and they said it usually takes 5 to 7 years to recover, and this has become sort of the standard line. They were talking about individual countries or individual regions like Asia in the 1990s,
right.
where there were other parts of the world acting as locomotives of growth. I don't – right now, if you look around the horizon, where is the engine of growth? It's not here. It's not East Asia. It's not the developing countries. It's not Europe. In fact, what we found out from after the crash in 2008, people had been talking before that about decoupling, that is the idea that – the world economy now was sufficiently vigorous, and particularly developing countries, that they no longer needed the American market to drive it. It turned out to be completely wrong. It turns out that American consumers borrowing in order to afford what they couldn't afford with wages had been buying goods in China, many of whose ingredients, as in the case of the iPhone, actually came from other industrial countries like Japan and West Germany and South Korea, and which consumed raw materials from developing countries like Brazil. So the entire Ponzi scheme was actually centered on the debt-strapped American consumer. And until wages are raised in other parts of the world, or there's some alternate form of public investment to get demand going, I think we're looking at a very, very slow recovery, if you can even call it a recovery at all.
And, of course, the political consequences of this are very bizarre, because my suspicion is that Romney may well be the next president. And if you see what happened in Wisconsin, the ability to spend unlimited amounts of money and get people, just barrage them into sort of submission, it's almost a sort of political version of the Stockholm syndrome. And there is no representation or no articulation of defending the American dream, defending the middle class, and restoring the America that you've written about before the great dismantling.
Well, this is not surprising if you look at the history of depressions. We've essentially had three depressions since the Industrial Revolution began. You don't have depressions before you have mass production industry, because you don't get mismatches between supply and demand in a village blacksmith economy. So the first Great Depression was the Long Depression of the 1870s through 1890s. Then you get the second depression in the 1930s. This is really a third global depression, even though we call it a recession. What happened in those previous two in most countries was that forces of the authoritarian, nationalist, populist right came to power. And there is a certain perverse logic to this. That is, when it turns out that either the economy is shrinking or it's not growing as rapidly as you anticipated, people are less generous. In every group in society, the rich, the middle class, the people who have votes and influence, they scramble to save what they have by forcing the other groups that are less politically organized in order to swallow the losses for all of this wealth that has just disappeared. And you find the same thing among nations with trade wars and rival currency devaluations and all of that. So again, I don't want to, you know, encourage people to go buy gold and, you know, stock up on firearms or anything.
Cans of tuna and live in the bush, right.
But we're, you know, it's the, as Churchill said in the early years of World War II, it's the end of the beginning. It's not the beginning of the end. But I am confident that what will emerge from this period, which I think will go on, you know, maybe a decade or two, it will be as different in the United States and in Europe and Asia as the world of the 1950s was from the world of the 1920s. This is a period of really major change for the first time in a long time.
Well, just in closing, Michael Lynn, without characterizing what kind of change we have ahead of us, do you think, I mean, first of all, there's an appalling lack of education, which I think is an element in why people will vote against their interests. Not that anybody's giving them a good narrative of what their interests are. But at the end of the day, it seems to me that tied in with this pervasive ignorance is jingoism and we're the greatest country on earth and all of this kind of stuff. And yet, you know, even Exxon's running commercials saying that we're not. But on the other hand, you could make the argument that even though we're not as good as we say we are, we still could be better.
Well, if you look at the previous reinventions of the American Republic, at great cost in blood and treasure and suffering, in crises like the Civil War and the New Deal, which involved violent labor battles, among other things, and then it was followed by World War II, when the smoke clears, the system is still corrupt and jingoistic, but it's better than it was before. You know, slavery has been abolished. You know, you have a 40-hour work week. So the country does advance, I think, over the long run, two steps forward, one step back. I think we've been taking one step back from the last advance in the last 30 or 40 years. You know, I am an optimist enough, having titled my book Land of Promise. I've quoted Churchill before, so I'll quote him again in a different context. He said, the Americans can be counted on to do the right thing when they have exhausted the alternatives. And I hope he's right.
Thank you very much for joining us here, Michael.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. His latest book is Land of Promise, An Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back, joined in the studio by a Syrian filmmaker.
Come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.